Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And it's nobody here but us chickens today. It's a host episode. So sit back and relax. We're going to talk about Minute 39, The Saboteur. And Hal, why don't you bring us up to date on what's going on in that Brooklyn nightmare called, let you do the explaining.
There's a lot of activity, a lot of things happening.
Yes.
In the Brooklyn laboratory, a deafening explosion rocks the chamber, shattering the triumphant air. Glass flies and sparks erupt as Fred Clemson, the unassuming State Department official, snatches a vial of the glowing blue serum from the chaos. A doctor, staggering amid the debris, shouts, "Stop him!" Dr. Abraham Erskine lurches forward, desperate to intervene, but Clemson, the Hydra agent Kruger, draws a pistol and fires. The shots ring out and Erskine collapses, blood pooling beneath him, his eyes glazing over as life fades. Kruger bolts up the stairway, getting winged by Agent Carter's pistol. Kruger slips through the smoke and confusion, disappearing into the facility's corridors with the stolen serum. Peggy follows in pursuit. Steve tries to see what he can do to help Erskine, but the wounds are too great. Erskine points a finger at Steve's chest, reminding Steve of his promise to be a good man. Erskine passes away. Steve Rogers, now filled with resolve, leaps up to pursue Kruger. At the entrance of the antique storefront, the elderly woman at the front desk pulls out a machine gun to stop Kruger, but is shot by him before she can raise the barrel. As she falls, he grabs the machine gun from her hands and bolts out the front door. His compatriot stands by with a waiting getaway car, only to be shot by undercover SSR agents on the street. Kruger jumps into the car and drives away, firing at the agents with the plundered machine gun. Peggy Carter runs into the street and sees the fleeing vehicle.
Wow, what a lot of action filled.
A lot of action. And yeah. Not a lot of dialogue.
And a big death there with losing Dr. Erskine.
Yeah, and that's a sad, I mean, that's obviously, it's a sad moment in the film, but it's sad too, just because we've talked so much about Erskine and you know, what Stucci does with that character, and what a presence he is and what a comforting sort of anchor he is through this first segment of the film, that it's like, the viewer feels that loss too. Now we're a little bit adrift.
Yeah, he's the Mercutio of the piece. I think he's just he's the guy you really enjoy. He's the, and not an organizing sensibility, but at least the trusted avuncular friend. This would be like losing Peavy in The Rocketeer.
He's the bedrock of you know, Steve's development. My attention was grabbed by the look Steve gives when he realizes Erskine's dead, and he kind of looks up and glowers like with determination. And it occurred to me, I'd seen that. First of all, it's a common enough thing to be a trope where the hero loses his father figure or his mother figure and, you know, is filled with resolve. But I think it's the exact same look Luke Skywalker gives Obi-Wan Kenobi when he realizes his aunt and uncle have been killed by the stormtroopers. It's that you know, eyes downcast and then looking at the horizon with "let's go get those guys" kind of thing.
Right.
It's
my
a
life
trope,
just
but
changed,
it's,
and
yeah, exactly. You this is the point where Steve's life changes from one thing to another thing. Mm-hmm. He's crossed the Rubicon.
Well, and the fact that he's just come out of this excruciating procedure, he's been on his feet for just, you know, a matter of moments. And it intrigues me that through this minute, we see more of this coming up, but that Steve Rogers is going to do what skinny Steve would have done. And that's take off running and try to do something to help. But now all of a sudden he's got this whole different machine, this whole different tool set to work with in his new super soldier body. So it's interesting to watch. It will be interesting as we go forward watching that play out as well.
Yeah, I did one thing that really jumped out at me in this is I need to ask Joe, if we have him on the show again, about the woman that supposedly runs the antique store with a rather lethal machine gun. That scene is almost note for note from the 1974 Three Days of the Condor film. If you've seen that film, Robert Redford works for a CIA offshoot that does they do research on library books and try to figure out if different novels have any background in actual CIA operations. And it also has a little old lady at the front desk who has a machine gun underneath the front of her desk. And she gets, well, I don't want to spoil too much, but she gets wiped out by an opposing force that comes through the front door in pretty much the same way. Just having a shootout with a little old lady seems to be quite a turn. And now I'm just wondering if it is a trope, just that I'll have to ask Joe if he picked up on that.
That's a real nice homage. I'll bet, you know, Joe's too smart not to have known that, but not everybody sees every movie.
That's true.
And by coincidence, you know, Robert Redford becomes part of the MCU.
There you go.
plays large in Captain and Steve's life. That's funny. I hadn't thought about 3 Days of the Condor. I hadn't seen that in forever. But you get a little bit of from Russia with Love, like that old lady to me is like a much nicer Rosa Klebb in a way. like Rosa Klebb if she was on our side, or you know.
I think that woman could probably have knives in her shoes.
I hesitate to say it because it is a heroic character getting killed, but it almost plays as funny for me. It's almost humorous. This sweet old lady, you know, brandishing this Tommy gun. Unfortunately, she pulls it out a little too late, but it's almost a humorous beat, and yet it's not. Like I say, I almost feel bad saying that, but
yeah. Well, I think that makes it. I think that the beat is almost split in two. It's like, you know, okay, sweet old lady, and we know there's more to her already than meets the eye. But yeah, the Thompson comes up, and you're sort of laughing, and you're sort of surprised by it, and then you're maybe shocked. That gets cut off very abruptly when she gets killed. You know, unless you were still laughing as she was dying, Brian.
Not me. Maybe Jim.
That heartless O'Kane fellow.
I haven't been able to. I was hoping we could get her on the show, but unfortunately, now she's been done away with. And Amanda Walker, who is still with us at the time of our recording, I had a lot of questions for her because she does all these different wild. She's been in, you know, like Cloud Atlas and 28 Weeks Later and all these amazing little pieces. Wow. And I am not sure. I haven't dug down deep enough, but I think she was also the wife of the alien being who destroyed all the Hushnak in Star Trek: The Next Generation.
No, you think that's the same actor?
I think it is. So I'm.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Yeah, she just. She's a little old lady who's not afraid to, you know, whip out a Tommy gun.
She's one of those character actors who's played a little old lady probably since she was 35 too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, she's the Helen Hayes of her day.
Yeah. Oh, if true, that'd be wonderful. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and she was just in Doctor Who as old Ruby. So intriguing.
Kidding.
Yeah.
I had a note on Agent Carter. She's the only one who gets a shot off at the guy, and she wings him. And it's just another little moment that demonstrates her badassity. Yes. She's the only one who takes any effective action against Kruger / Clemson. And it reminded me of a moment that I forgot or missed the opportunity to remark upon earlier in the movie when the general throws the dummy grenade into the crowd of soldiers and Steve's the only one who dives on it. The only other person who moves toward the grenade instead of away from it is Peggy Carter. She makes a move toward the grenade. She's too far away. She's too slow. But Steve and Peggy peas in a pod. And this is just another little moment that says she's a formidable woman who's a heroic action.
Yeah, she's not a member of the audience. She's a participant.
Yeah, she takes charge.
Yes, definitely. Wow. I just keep wondering, the other thing that I wonder about, who's picking up the pieces back in the lab? Brandt's there. Phillips is still there. So what are they trying to rescue from? And the other thing that I kind of wonder about that, you know, somebody, you know, Kruger runs away with the last vial, but wouldn't, I mean, the super soldier serum That has to have been produced in, you know, as a known quantity. So whatever the machinery is for making that, it seems like they could still crank out a bunch of them. I don't know if it, you know, how does the secret die with Erskine? I didn't quite get that.
Mm.
Yeah, that is a good question. And what was there, do we know at this point, do we know anything of the sort of the secret ingredients or anything? Was it something, you know, we can draw the comparisons of the Manhattan Project, and we only had so much, uranium, plutonium to work with. Is there a finite supply of, you know, vitamin hero, I mean, or
maybe it's some kind of, you know, mixture whatever. Of adamantium and vibranium or something. That
Five drops of essence of terror.
Somebody's old.
It's a good question, and it also raises the question of why wasn't that serum in Steve? I mean, why was there one left? You know, the backup drive. I mean, clearly, Kruger/Clemson's motive was just to get that serum so they could take it back to Germany and analyze it and replicate it. But you raise a good question, Jim. Why don't they just have a 50-gallon drum of the stuff in the back room? Or know how to make it
I think that Erskine would want to at least write something down. But anyway, if you start digging too hard on that, then you don't have the rest of the Avengers.
Clearly, Erskine was just such a unique genius that he's like the winemaker, you know, the premier winemaker who's got the right blend, the right palate to put this blend together.
Sell no super serum before it's time. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. So I need to be mildly pedantic for one moment and point out, we're talking about Peggy and Brian. It was a great observation. Yeah. She's the one who reacts, one who gets something done, both here and in the grenade scenario. It's interesting to me that she is holding a Walther PPK, which is, you know, that's the James Bond gun, but in 1942, you know, that was what the, you know, SS officers and things were carrying, Wehrmacht officers as a smaller carry gun. So that's 100% a German weapon. So I look at it and you think, yeah, that makes sense. She's British and she has the Bond gun, but it wasn't the Bond gun until the 50s when the climate changed.
I keep forgetting what kind of weapon did the Rocketeer, our American friend, carry?
So he had a Mauser, so another German gun.
I mean, maybe that's the thing. Late 30s. Yeah.
Did he retrieve that? Didn't he retrieve that off of one of the fallen German soldiers?
The Sturmbach. I cannot pronounce. You can. You're better. You're German. The Stormtroopers. Sturmbach Tellen.
Yes, Sturmbach Tellen.
SA. Yes. He.
But anyway.
I'm thinking Peggy took it as a war trophy. She's had action we don't even know about.
Yeah, and it's 43. That's their 5 years into the war now. So,
that's a great point. That very well could just be a war trophy and be her thing. And so
I would, you know, I mean, I know they did Agent Carter in the post-war years, and we followed along with what Peggy was doing in New York and things like that in the ABC miniseries. But I would love pre Cap Peggy Carter finding out what she was doing back in the war how she became part of the SSR. That would be
because she's clearly very respected and resourceful and everything by the time we meet her in this movie. She's established.
I mean, you could easily see her getting, you know, dropped in occupied France in 41 and sweet talking Nazi agents into giving up secrets or getting, you know, pre-paperclip people over to help out the war effort in England.
So a quick straw poll amongst the hosts. Is there a man among us who would not tell her anything she wanted to know?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Make sure I wasn't alone there.
All right.
Fine. Here's the
V2s. Here's are up secret here in the plan. Mountains.
Yeah. Did I give you my social security number yet? If I didn't, I meant to. I'm sorry.
I think I caught a blooper in this minute.
Really?
I may have. I'm not sure. You're going to have to check me on this, although you'd have to check the tape. 20 seconds into this, Kruger/Clemson is escaping. He's running down a hallway. There's two MPs. There's an MP on the right of the hallway and an MP on the left of the hallway. Kruger takes one shot, and they both go down.
Ooh.
So I don't know if, you know, the we're supposed to think the MP on the left shot the one on the right as he was being killed, but there's only one audible shot and two MPs go down.
So are you talking the 22nd mark?
About 20 seconds into this minute, yeah. Kruger's running down the hallway.
I see him running down the hall. I see him shoot. I see an MP fall.
There's one on the right who falls backwards into another doorway or hallway.
But that guy's wearing a lab coat.
Okay, maybe he's not.
So I think the guy on the right is just starting to come out and saying, oh, God, guns, and he's falling
back.
Oh,
he's on his way. Okay.
That's my suspicion. But
well, you know,
they don't pay me enough for this.
Yeah.
All right. Let's say it's not a blooper. I always enjoy the bloopers, though, that show, stunt action like in a Star Wars movie or something where characters are just falling down for no reason.
Right.
There's a couple of famous ones. Luke Skywalker's kicking a guy off the sand barge, except he's nowhere near the guy's face kind of thing. So I'm always kind of alert for those opportunities. This may not be one of them.
I do want to know why banjos and ukuleles are bought and sold and repaired. It's like,
I had never noticed that until just now. And someone who has a modest collection of ukuleles, that's one more reason I want to go back to this world.
I would not call it modest. No, I would. That is not a modest collection. And more than four is definitely unmodest.
It's unnecessary. It's not hoarding. I mean, I really have restricted it.
They fit on the wall.
With one exception, I just have one in each category. And now there's a
lot of kinds of ukuleles.
Well, there are, but I mean, it's just in terms of soprano and tenor, and I've got an 8-string and a banjolele. And as of Christmas time, I have a ukulele bass, which is the funnest bass guitar I've ever played in my life. It's not a guitar, but now I want to go back here. And of course, we'd all want to go to the bookstore that we see on this same block.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. But the banjo repair facility in the middle of Brooklyn, which, is known as the banjo capital of New York.
Hal, just when I thought I couldn't respect you anymore, my esteem for you has just gone through the roof. That's fantastic.
I don't understand, but I'll take it.
We'll be having a ukulele festival in the coming episode. So please stay tuned.
Yeah, we will.
We do get another look at this. This beautiful take on 1940s Brooklyn. I think at the last shot, you can see, is it the Chrysler Building or the Empire State Building in the background? You can see one of the skyscrapers of Manhattan in the background. As we look down the street.
That's further downtown. That's probably, that's actually in Brooklyn.
It's the one that looks like the Los Angeles Hall of Justice. Kind of. It's that similar shape. But
I'm trying to remember the name.
Great to see
that's not in Manhattan. That's actually in Brooklyn.
Well, I don't know Brooklyn, so I appreciate the correction. But in any case, it's just beautiful, beautiful design work here. You really feel like you're there.
Yeah, it's I'm going to be looking for the, and I know people in Brooklyn are going to be very upset about that I couldn't remember the name of it. But if it comes in, I will probably drop it in at this point at a later editing date. This is a very, it feels very much like Brooklyn. And this, to me, the only really long street in Brooklyn is Flatbush Avenue. And this is not, this is too narrow to be Flatbush Avenue. I do enjoy all the beautiful old cars. I think I spotted a Pontiac there. Hal might know these better. There's a couple of Chevys, but the beautiful grill on that Pontiac is unmistakable.
Yeah. The cars are beautiful. The design of this, the art design is just gorgeous. It's those sepia brown tones we've talked about so much that are just so evocative of the time and place. You can just feel the grime. You can feel the grime from the, smoke stacks 10 miles away kind of thing.
Yeah, it's... definitely has a, it's that whole, again, the muted tone, the browns, the yellows, you feel like you're looking at a sepia image of Brooklyn again.
Yeah. And it brings you back to this time and place after you come out of this, this laboratory, which also looks a little antique-y because of the design aesthetic we discussed before, but you come out of that into this grimy brown street of kids playing and laundry hanging off the fire escapes, and it's a little jarring, but it brings you back to that reality, I think.
And I just, and as we were chatting, I was scanning through a map of Brooklyn and trying to figure out where, and it's the Williamsburg Savings Bank Tower, which is known.
Thank you, Jim.
It was the tallest building at 512 feet. So almost as tall as the Washington Monument.
You've redeemed me.
Yeah,
thank you. Me and my stupid unknowledge of New York.
It held. Well, you're on the other coast, so it's okay. You get exemptions for that. But it held the title.
I was just there 2 weeks ago, and I couldn't have told you to save my life that was.
It held the title of Brooklyn's tallest building from 1929 till 2009, when they built the Brooklyner high-rise apartment. So I can't imagine. Now I'm trying to picture a 600-foot tall apartment house in Brooklyn. Wow.
Wow. I think we've all learned something here today.
Yeah, I think it's, yes. Don't never trust the woman in the antique store, because she might be having a... I hope the banjos are okay next door. All those bullets flying through the wall.
What issue of the banjos?
Yeah, twang. At least there wasn't an accordion and bagpipe store nearby.
Well-deserved shootout. Yeah,
that's next door.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think we've pretty much burned this one into the ground. But there's lots more to come, and we've got some interesting guests coming up in the next few episodes. So please join us here soon. I do want to thank our audience for being a part of all this. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base at Facebook. And if you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at whatever podcast streaming service where you found this episode. So please check back on our big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.